So, I hope you can hear me. I haven't got a very loud voice. If you can't hear me, kind of wave or something, or just move. Can you hear me? Can you hear me? Yes. So this is part of a series of stories of evenings we're having over the summer with different people among us, just telling stories from, I suppose, from the Buddhist tradition, which is a very broad thing. The Buddhist tradition is 2,500 years old, and it's spread to multiple countries outside India, and all kinds of people have stories to tell. So far, the stories, I think, have been pretty much from the Buddha, the time of the Buddha, and the stories I want to tell are from the time of the Buddha. But that might change as we go along. And I thought before I started telling any stories, I'd just say a few words about the Buddhist scriptures generally. Partly because I want to say, if you haven't read the actual Buddhist scriptures, I really recommend it. I think they're great. They are fantastic. Like I said, there's a huge amount of them, and they cover 2,500 years, and they're just a very rich collection of stories, mostly. And one thing about them is that the Buddhist scriptures obviously originated with the Buddha, because he started the Buddhist tradition. But the Buddha was enlightened, and the whole point of Buddhist practice over the millennia is to get enlightened yourself. And once you get enlightened yourself, you almost speak with what's called Buddha Vachana. Buddha Vachana means Buddha voice. So your speech can contribute directly to the Buddhist scriptures, because you're on that same level of enlightenment, if you like. So over the years, the Buddhist scriptures have kind of grown as more and more people have got enlightened and contributed. So there's a whole literature of Tibetan teachers, a whole literature of Japanese Zen teachers, a whole literature of Chinese Chan masters. All the Buddhist countries, Sri Lanka, Thailand, Vietnam, Korea, etc., have contributed, you know, from their own teachers. Did I mention Tibet? Very much Tibet. Not to mention other Indian teachers through the centuries. So the whole collection is enormous. And even if you just stick with the stories about the Buddha, that's one collection out of all these possible collections, that's pretty enormous. So the main collection we have of stories about the Buddha is what's called the Pali Canon. Pali is the language, and canon just means collection. So the Pali Canon. And if you bought all the books in the Pali Canon, they'd be about 10,000 pages worth, which is quite a lot of books, quite a lot of big books. And then all these, all that literature has commentaries on it. So the commentaries of the Pali Canon would be a lot larger. I don't know how many pages, because it's not all been translated, but at least another 10,000 pages, at least. That's all the commentaries. Then you get sub-commentaries and so on and so on. And so it goes on. Just to give you one example, one of the most famous Buddhist scriptures, quite a small one, is the Dhammapada. Just a little collection of verses, maybe 300 verses. And if we get time, I'll tell a story from the Dhammapada. So the Dhammapada has a commentary. You can buy the Dhammapada in a book about that big, quite small. The Dhammapada commentary is translated into English, and you can buy it in 6 volumes. It's called Buddhist Legends, as it happens. But this little book has this much commentary on it. So anyway, most of all this stuff is stories. And most of it is stories about meetings between people. So when the Buddha was alive, he just walked on foot around India for 40 or 45 years, meeting people, more or less at random. You never quite know who he was going to meet next. And when he met somebody, some conversation happened, and then usually some teaching was given. And so what's come down to us is lots of stories and then lots of teachings. And sometimes you get a big story and a little teaching, and sometimes it's a little story and a long teaching. It varies. But I personally love the stories as much as the actual teachings. I love it. And what you get a very strong feeling for is that human nature hasn't really changed over 2,500 years and between the continent of England and the whole West. It's like people are people in all their kind of strangeness. So the Buddha met all these people who are pretty much like us. So what I'd like to do is tell at least 2 stories and possibly 4. I'll see how the time goes. And we told some stories on Dharma Day, which was last weekend, which was the Buddha when he first started teaching. So he was enlightened and he decided to teach and he got up and he walked off and he started meeting people. And he was... his first couple of attempts... Well, his first attempt to teach was unsuccessful, and his second attempt was hard work but successful. And the feeling I've always had from those meetings is that he was very, very full of his enlightenment experience, very, very confident in it, very kind of charged up by the fact he was now enlightened. He was enlightened and he knew it. He really did, he knew it. And I don't say he was boastful, but he was certainly proud. But anyway, his first couple of attempts kind of put people off. So I've chosen a couple of stories where the Buddha is still proud of being enlightened, but he's obviously learnt, I would say he's learnt, you know, a slightly more gentle approach to interacting with people and a very successful approach. Yeah? So I'll tell a couple of stories and see... maybe we'll have a pause then and just see what discussion comes out of it, and then a couple more stories. Yeah, and I'll kind of alternate between telling the story in my own words and reading from the scripture, just so you know I'm not making it up. Yeah. So this is from the Pali Canon, and this one is called the Bharadvaja Sutta, just because it's named after some character called Bharadvaja. So basically, the Buddha is walking along, and it's the morning time, and he's looking for food. So he was a monk, he got his food by begging, he had to eat before 12 o'clock, and he was looking for somebody who was happy to feed him. And he bumps into these farmers who were busy farming, obviously quite profitable farmers. So I'll read just the introduction. So on one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Dakinagiri Monastery in the Brahma village Ekanala in Magadha. Most of these places are long lost. You have no idea where they are. They're lost in the jungle. So anyway, there he was. Now at that time, it was the sowing season, and 500 ploughs of the Brahmin Bharadvaja were put to use. So they're all out in the fields, sowing, you know, ploughing and sowing and stuff. So in the morning, the Blessed One, having dressed himself, took bowl and robe and went to the place where the Bharadvaja's work was going on. It was the time of food distribution by the Brahmin, and the Blessed One drew near and stood at one side. Now, this is where the conversation starts. And all we've got is the words on the page. And you have to imagine the tone of voice. And I quite like imagining the tone of voice or the mood of the speakers. You don't know if you get it right or not, but anyway. Anyway, we'll see what you think. So Bharadvaja, seeing the Blessed One standing there, waiting for alms, said to him, "Recluse, I plough and sow, and having ploughed and sow, I eat. You too, recluse, should plough and sow. And having ploughed and sown, you can eat too." So I don't know what tone of voice that is, but I get a sort of, who do you think you are, you lazy, good for nothing. However, the Buddha, with his Buddha pride, says this. He says, "I too, Brahmin, plough and sow, and having ploughed and sow, I eat." So Bharadvaja says, again you imagine the tone of voice, "We do not see the Venerable Gotama's yoke, or plough, or ploughshare, or goad, or oxen. Nevertheless, you say, I too plough and sow, and having ploughed and sow, I eat." So, and then actually the Bharadvaja follows it up with a little poem. I don't know why, but he follows it up with a poem. So the Bharadvaja says, "You profess to be a ploughman, yet your plough we do not see. Asked about your plough, tell us of them, that we may know." That probably rhymes in the original Pali. Yeah. So, yes, he says, well, yeah, where's your plough? You say you plough and sow, but where is it? So then the Buddha also replies in verse, in poetry. And I'll read you a bit of what he says. So the Buddha says, "Faith is my seed, austerity the rain, wisdom my yoke and plough, modesty is the pole, mindfulness the strap, and so mind is the strap, and mindfulness my ploughshare and goad. Controlled in speech and conduct, guarded in deed and speech, abstemious in food, I make truth my weed cutter, Arahant my complete deliverance. Exertion is my oxen, drawing me to Nibbana's security, and on it goes without stopping. Where one goes, whither goes one who does not suffer? Thus is this ploughing ploughed, which bears the fruit of deathlessness. Having ploughed in this way, one is freed from every ill." So that's what the Buddha says in a kind of poetic manner. Kind of, well, it's a metaphor, isn't it? You know, faith is my seed. And I get a sort of a nice sense of pride from the Buddha replying. He's not intimidated by the Brahmin. But it's almost playful. You know, there's a bit of an... The Brahmin refers to the oxen and the plough, and the Buddha refers to his metaphorical oxen and plough. So that's half the story. Then the other half is more kind of curious. I'll tell you and see what you think. So, the Bharadvaja, it was after all the time of food distribution, kind of softens, he kind of relents. And he fills a golden bowl with milk rice and offers it to the Blessed One, saying, "May the Venerable Gotama partake of this milk rice. A ploughman indeed is the Venerable Gotama, who ploughs a plough for the fruit of deathlessness." So that's nice. He gets offered a golden bowl. But the Buddha says, no. The Buddha says, no. The Buddha says, "If I receive food by reciting verses, I will not eat it." He doesn't sing for his supper. No. That's an English phrase. "I do not sing for my supper. It is not the tradition of those who practice right livelihood. The Buddhas reject what is received by reciting verses. This, Brahman, is the conduct of the Buddhas as long as Dhamma reigns." Then the Buddha goes on, he says, "To the holy consummate, taintless and well-disciplined great sages, you should offer other food and drink. Sure field is that for merit-seeking men." So, that's an interesting little incident. And yes, the Brahmin offers him food, but the Buddha says no. And it's a bit like the farmer is rewarding him for performing, but the Buddha isn't into being rewarded for performing. He wants to. He's begging food just because he's a holy man. This is one of the suttas where Sankaracharya's done a whole commentary on it, and he makes the point that this was a Brahmin village, and this farmer was a Brahmin. And the Brahmins were like the professional priests of India. And what they did was perform all kinds of religious services for pay. So they got very wealthy for doing all their sacrifices and stuff, but they expected to be paid. But the Buddha had no interest in being paid in any way for performing in any way. And in fact, he was quite definitely saying, no, that's not what I do. Anyway, so the Buddha says no. Bharadvaja takes it in good spirit, and he says, "Okay, to whom then, Venerable Gotama, shall I give this milk rice? I mean, here it is in the golden bowl. What shall I do?" Then the Buddha says something even more puzzling, which is a bit of a mystery. And he says, "Brahmin," he says to the farmer, "Brahmin, In this world of devas and maras and brahmins and the whole generation of recluses and deities and humans, there is no one who could digest this milk rice except the Tathagata, except him, except the Buddha, or the disciple of a Tathagata. So, Brahmin, now either cast this milk rice on the ground where there is no grass, or into water where there are no living creatures. In other words, throw it away, but carefully. So the Brahmin flung the milk rice into water where there was no living creatures, and the milk rice, thrown into the water, smoked and steamed, making a noise, just like a ploughshare heated during the day when thrown into the water, smokes and steams, making the noise, chikitata, chikitata. So it's boiling hot, obviously. Then the Brahmin, Bharadvaja, alarmed, with hair standing on end, approached and fell with his head at the Blessed One's feet and said as follows, "Most excellent, O Gotama, is thy teaching, most excellent." And he says a few more things, but that's a strange little incident. The Buddha says no one can digest this food. You must throw it away where, you know, nobody will be harmed by it. He throws it away and it's obviously red hot, almost radioactive. And why, it doesn't say. There's no explanation. But it works. But it definitely happens. And Bharadvaja is suitably impressed. He obviously thinks the Blessed One is, you know, the real deal. Because he immediately turns to the Buddha and says, "Most excellent is your teaching. Just as a man would set upright what's been overturned, reveal what's been concealed, point out the way to one gone astray, bring an oil lamp into the darkness, even so the Dhamma has been declared by the Venerable Gotama. I take refuge in the Venerable Gotama, in the Dhamma and Sangha, and wish to receive the novice's ordination." So the Bharadvaja duly received both ordinations from the Blessed One, and living alone and aloof and diligent and strenuous and resolute, ere long, by his own insight, realized and attained the highest perfection of the noble life. So Bharadvaja became the Buddha's disciple, practiced hard, and became enlightened. So that's nice. But it doesn't explain this curious incident of the food. And Sangharakshita's explanation, which I don't know if it's speculation or based on fact somehow, is that when you offer food to a holy man, it's kind of charged by whatever power that holy man has, almost like an electric current. And then only somebody on that level can safely eat it or digest it. And because it had been offered to the Buddha, it was charged at that kind of level, and nobody apart from the Buddha or his disciple could digest it. So I don't know if that's true or what, but that's Sangharakshita's explanation. And that might have been a traditional view in the Buddha's time, but it doesn't actually tell us. Yes. So that is the end of the first story, the meeting with Bharadvaja, and a little kind of poetic exchange between the two, which I like because it shows the pride of the Buddha. He wasn't intimidated by this rich guy with all the kind of oxen and ploughs and blah, blah, blah. And he wasn't intimidated because he was poor and needed food. He was quite happy to stand there and hold his own. So I'll tell a second story, which is kind of similar, and then see what we think. I just need to look it up. There we go, yes. So this is another, the Buddha meeting another farmer. I think there were lots of farmers at the time. It was the main industry, really. And this one, it just launches straight into the dialogue between the two. It doesn't explain where it was or what happened or anything. But you can kind of infer it. So I think this one happened not in the morning time when the Buddha's looking for food, but in the evening time when the Buddha is looking for accommodation, so somewhere to sleep the night. And I think both stories, the Buddha's on his own. There's no hint of any other followers. He He's just wondering about a single person, you know, meeting who he meets, but no big entourage or anything. But certainly doesn't talk about it. So the way I see this is he's wandering along and it's evening is falling and he's looking for somewhere to sleep and he meets this other farmer. And I visualise this other farmer leaning up against a gate, looking out on his field where his cows are, feeling at peace with the world. Okay, and the only other detail is that it's about to pour with rain, which probably is why the Buddha wants somewhere to sleep in a hurry. So this farmer is called Dhaniya the cattleman. So he says, this is just the beginning of the sutta, he says, the rice is cooked. My milking is done. I live with my people along the banks of the Mahi. My hut is roofed. My fire is lit. So if you want to, rain god, go ahead and rain. That's what it says. I'm all right. I'm good. So the Buddha answers him in verse, and same sort of thing. He says, free from anger, my stubbornness gone. I live for one night on the banks of the Mahi. My hut's roof is open. My fire is out. So if you want rain god, go ahead and rain. And Dhaniya says, no mosquitoes or gadflies are to be found. The cows range in the marshy meadow where the grasses flourish. They can stand the rain if it comes. So if you want rain god, go ahead and rain. And the Buddha says, a raft well made has been lashed together. Having crossed over, gone to the far shore, I've subdued the flood. No need for a raft is to be found. So if you want rain god, go ahead and rain. I'll just kind of read it and see what you think. Dhaniya says, my wife is compliant. Obviously a good thing in those days. Not careless. She's charming. Has lived with me long. I hear no evil about her at all. So if you want rain god, go ahead and rain. The Buddha says, my mind is compliant. Released, has long been nurtured, well tamed. No evil is to be found in me at all. So if you want rain god, go ahead and rain. And Dhaniya says, I support myself on my earnings. My sons live in harmony, free from disease. I hear no evil about them at all. So if you want rain god, go ahead and rain. The Buddha says, I am in no one's employment. I'm in no one's employment. I wander the whole world on the reward of my awakening. No need for earnings is to be found. So if you want rain god, go ahead and rain. Dhaniya says, there are cows, young bulls, cows in calf and breeding cows, and a great bull, leader of the herd. So if you want rain god, go ahead and rain. He has all those things. I think in those days they almost measured their possessions in cows. I have so many cows. The Buddha says, I have no cows, no young bulls, no cows in calf or breeding cows, no great bull, leader of the herd. So if you want rain god, go ahead and rain. He has nothing. And one more. Dhaniya says, the stakes, the fences, are dug in, immovable. The new grass halters, the ropes, well woven. Not even young bulls could break. So if you want rain god, go ahead and rain. And the Buddha, you can feel a bit of Buddha pride coming out at this point. He says, having broken my bonds like a great bull, like a great elephant tears a rotting vine, I never again will lie in the womb. So if you want rain god, go ahead and rain. And then it says, the great cloud rained down, filling the lowlands and highlands. Hearing the rain god pour down, Dhaniya said, how lucky we are that we've gazed on the Blessed One. We go to him, the one with vision for refuge. May you be our teacher, great sage. My wife and I are compliant. Let's follow the holy life under the one well gone, the Buddha. going to the far shore, let's put an end to suffering and stress. And that's the end. So that's quite a, that's kind of similar, but the same sort of sense of Buddha pride and sort of meeting somebody, you know, with the same sort of repartee almost, poetry. But in this one, the Buddha was a bit more kind of paradoxical. Rather than saying, I plough as well, and I sow seeds as well, and I, you know, I'm a farmer as well, he says, I have no cows, no this, no that, no hut, no roof, no wife, no nothing. He's more kind of negating, in poetic spirit, negating what Dānya valued, all these things he valued. The Buddha takes pride in not having them. Not. In the commentary here, by the way, it says, obviously cows and fields and things are a bit old-fashioned these days. Not many people have cows. So you can just substitute stocks and shares for cattle and bulls. And substitute the stock market for rain downpours. The stock market crashes for rain downpours. Then you get a more contemporary feel for it. I have no shares, I have no bonds, I have no savings. One reason I was interested in these stories is that I do get the feeling the Buddha had a lot of confident pride. And pride is a slightly double-edged thing. You can be proud in quite the wrong way, or you can have quite a healthy pride. And if you're leading a spiritual life and you haven't got much money and you have given up all kinds of things, you can't have pride on the basis of worldly success because you might not have it. But it's good to have pride in your spiritual integrity. Do you see what I mean? And I feel the Buddha had that in spades, in an abundance. Should I tell another story in a similar sort of theme?
Yeah.
Yes? See how the time's going? Yeah. So this is... I'm not sure what you make of this, but anyway. One thing about these stories is they've all been faithfully handed down for 2,500 years. So they're definitely in the Buddhist tradition. Anyway, who knows what really happened all those years ago, but this is faithfully handed down to us. So this is the story about a Buddha meeting what seems like a very unpleasant man. And it's a bit the same as the previous story. It's the Buddha meeting this character on his own level, with his own sort of energy. So it's from the Majjhima-nikāya of the Pali Canon. And at one time, the Blessed One lived in a peaked hall, rather nice, in the great forest. And at that time, Satchika, the son of a Nigantha, was a clever disputant, a good arguer, considered wise by many who lived in Vaishali. So this character... He would go around Vaishali saying, I do not see any other recluse, Brahmin, leader of a crowd, teacher of a crowd, or anyone pretending to be enlightened, who does not shiver, tremble and sweat when he's invited to a dispute with me. Even a lifeless pillar drawn to a dispute by me would shiver and tremble. So what about a human being? They would be terrified. So this character, he likes an argument. He loves arguing. So one morning, one of the Buddha's disciples, the Venerable Asaji, goes to beg in the village in Vaishali and bumps into this character, Satchika, who approaches him, exchanges friendly greetings and stands on one side, very innocent beginning. And then he gets into conversation, obviously sort of seeking his argument. And he says, good Asaji, how are the disciples of the recluse Gotama trained? And how are they given a lot of training? And Asaji tells him, in a fairly simple, matter-of-fact way, what the Buddha teaches. The Buddha says, matter is impermanent. Feelings are impermanent. Perceptions are impermanent. Consciousness is impermanent. Matter is not the self. Feelings are not the self. Perceptions are not the self. Consciousness is not the self. Satchika says, this is ridiculous. This is something which should not be heard. If the recluse Gotama really is of this view, we should meet him for a conversation. We should dispel his doubts on this matter. So, he's got two different names, actually, this character, but Satchika then goes into the marketplace where there's 500 locals assembled for some purpose. And Satchika goes to these 500 locals and says, "Come, today there's going to be a dispute between me and Gotama, the recluse Gotama. If the recluse Gotama affirms this view we've just heard, we will draw him into a dispute, pulling him about and dragging him about, like a strong man taking hold of a sheep would pull it about and drag it about, or like an elephant descending into a deep pond would throw the vegetation about. We will throw the recluse Gotama about. Come, Lichavis, there will be a dispute between me and the recluse Gotama." So, after a little bit of discussion, they all head off into the forest to find the Buddha and have this argument. And they get to where the Buddha and his disciples are staying, and they say, "Where's the Buddha?" It almost feels like a bit of a lynch mob going to find their victim. Anyway, they are told the Blessed One has entered the great forest and is seated at the foot of a tree to spend the day. But never mind, they head off themselves into the great forest to find the Buddha. And they find him, and they exchange friendly greetings with him, and sit down on one side. And it's all quite polite. And then Satchika, the son of the Nigantha, says thus to the Blessed One, "We would like to ask a certain question to good Gotama. If good Gotama would give us leave and would explain it to us, please." And the Blessed One said, "Ask whatever you desire." So Satchika says, "Is this teaching yours, that feelings are impermanent, form is impermanent, consciousness is impermanent, feelings are not the self, the body is not the self, consciousness is not the self, and so on?" And the Buddha says, "Yes, that is true. That is my teaching." And then Satchika says, "Good Gotama, a comparison occurs to me. Just as the seed and flowers grow and develop, established and supported on the earth, so does, I'm paraphrasing it slightly, so do spiritual qualities grow and flourish dependent on the body. Just as, flowers and seeds grow supported on earth, so do feelings, so do spiritual qualities arise dependent on feelings," and so on. "So, if you say matter and so on is not myself, you are wrong." This is slightly identical, but this is his point. So, the Buddha says, "I will cross-question you and answer as you please." And Ajivasana says, Satchika says, "Yes." So he says, Satchika says, "This is my view, and this is also the view of the crowd. This is the view of this large crowd." The Buddha says, "No, you should dispute on your view and your view alone. Never mind the crowd. What do you know about the crowd?" The Buddha says, "I will cross-question you on this and answer as it pleases." So he says, "Satchika, do anointed kings, great kings, have power over their kingdoms to execute those who should be executed, to produce those that should be produced, to banish those that have to be banished?" And Satchika says, "Yes, great kings have power over their subjects." So far, so good. Then the Buddha says, "Satchika, you say that matter and feelings and consciousness and so on is yourself. Right or wrong?" He says, "Yes, matter and feelings and so on is myself." The Buddha says, "Satchika, do you have power over your body? Do you have power over your feelings? Do you have power over your consciousness? Do you wield power over your body in the same way that kings can wield power?" When this was said, Satchika, the son of Nigantha, became silent. He was not sure how to answer. But a second time the Blessed One said, you say the matter is yourself. Do you wield power over that matter? May my matter be thus or not thus? For the second time, Satchika was silent. For the third time, he said the question, and the third time, he was silent. But then the Buddha said, explain yourself, Satchika. This is not the time for you to be silent. If somebody does not reply to a rightful question asked by the Buddha for the third time, his head splits into seven pieces. Now, at that moment, Vajrapani, the demon, was seen in space with a flaming thunderbolt in his hand, as though to split the head of Satchika if he did not reply to the rightful question asked the third time by the Buddha. Vajrapani, the demon, was seen by both the Buddha and Satchika. Then Satchika, the son of the Nagantha, was frightened and with hairs standing on end, sought the refuge and protection of the Blessed One. So, now, so now Satchika says, it's true, I do not have power over my body, I do not have power over my feelings, I do not have power over my consciousness. And the Buddha says, attend carefully and reply carefully, Satchika. What you said earlier does not agree with what you say now. And the Buddha calls him out in all these different ways, his body, his feelings, his consciousness. Then he says, Ajivesana, what do you think now? Is matter permanent or impermanent? And now Satchika says, impermanent, good Gautama. And so on and so on and so on. And gradually, the Buddha forces, or maybe not forces, but leads Satchika to admit that actually things are impermanent, that he doesn't have power over his body and his feelings, that actually he cannot see his body and his feelings, his consciousness, as self. In other words, leads him to the same perspective as his own. So, then he says, Satchika, with your own answers, being cross-questioned, we, studying you, found you to be empty, useless and wrong. This is the Buddha speaking. We have found you to be empty, useless and wrong. Now, have you said to these people in Vaishali such a thing like this? I don't see a recluse who, when drawn into a dispute by me, would not shiver, tremble and sweat. Have you said that? Now look at you, Ajivesana, there is sweat trickling down your forehead, and drops of sweat have pierced your shawl and fallen onto the ground. But on my body, at the moment, there is no sweat, says the Buddha. Saying that, the Buddha disclosed his golden-hued body to the gathering. When this was said, Satchika became silent, confused, his form drooping, his face turned down, unable to reply, and sat down. And that's pretty much the end. So that's a slightly shocking story, if you like, of the Buddha putting up with no nonsense from some character, which these days we might feel rather bad manners and rather violent almost. But it's an example of the Buddha meeting somebody very argumentative on his very argumentative level and not backing down at all and just forcing that argument through to a resolution. So I thought that was worth including, just because all these stories give you little insights into what the Buddha was like. Mm. We've got an image of the Buddha as rather sweet, very calm, very peaceful, very nice, very compassionate. But this is a story about the Buddha being fierce and almost having demons at his power that would split your head into seven pieces if you didn't answer properly. So the technicalities of the story about matter and feelings are not quite the point that I wanted to make. It's more like, you know, this is what the Buddha was like. He was quite fierce sometimes.